It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we look at how Rachel Carson and her book Silent Spring changed the way humans think about nature. She's the subject of a new PBS film that starts airing tonight on Wisconsin Public Television.
First, the ACLU of Wisconsin has filed a class action lawsuit against Wisconsin officials over the alleged mistreatment of young people at the state's two youth prisons.
Both the Lincoln Hills School for Boys and the Copper Lake School for Girls have been under investigation for abuse for some time now, but the new lawsuit alleges that while some changes have been made, the inmates are still receiving cruel and unusual punishment.
Larry Dupuy is with us now. He's the legal director for the ACLU in Wisconsin. Larry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, let's start by asking the question, why did the ACLU decide to bring this particular lawsuit now with the ongoing federal investigation still going on?
Well, we had initially, when the investigations became public, we obviously were concerned about the rights of these youth in up at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. And we hoped, I think with a lot of others, that the scrutiny that was coming to Lincoln Hills would be sufficient to lead to really meaningful reforms. Unfortunately, we continued to hear from both parents and public defenders and other defense attorneys who had clients up there that there were practices that, you know, they had stopped breaking bones, but there were other practices that were continuing that were nearly as barbaric, including extensive use of solitary confinement, 22 to 23 hours a day in a small cell with essentially nothing but a very low bed and a toilet in the cell, and very limited time out of that cell for education. And when out of the cell, an awful lot of the kids are on what they call being on the belt, which means they're locked in wrist shackles by a small short chain to a wrist a waist belt. And then for their supposed hour of exercise, they're chained to a table. And then we had heard about a lot of use of pepper spray, and when we went up to visit a couple of youth in October, we actually witnessed an incident in which a child was pepper sprayed after, you know, he appeared to be on the ground. I'm not sure exactly when the pepper spraying took place. There were a number of guards holding him down on the ground, and after a bit of struggle, they lifted him up and were dragging him in our direction and put him in a cage in a shower to give him an opportunity to wash the spray off, and then escorted him back to a cell where another guard had taken his mattress and left him with a hard rubber mat. And instead of regular clothes, he was in essentially a hospital gown. So, and it's astonishing. I mean, when the ACLU is in a prison, that kind of thing, you know, usually they know we're coming, and they try to make things look like they're going along hunky-dory, and it was astonishing to actually see that.
Now, the state has said that it has made some progress in addressing the problems at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, things like body cameras, things like having nurses dispense medication. Do you think those changes have helped make a difference?
Well, I think they've certainly been steps in the right direction. I don't want to say that there hasn't been anything done. I mean, that's certainly not true. There were concerns about the fact that guards were distributing medications and errors were resulting. And I also don't want to malign the guards. I mean, they have an extremely difficult job. They don't seem to have the tools or the training to do it appropriately, because this is unlike other systems around the country, which have come into the 21st, at least into the 20th century. I'm not sure we've gotten beyond the 19th here. And so, you know, they're caught in a system that's very difficult. They don't seem to be, you know, they seem to make some moves to improve things. They don't seem to be breaking bones. But we've seen some of the body cam video, and it shows what continues to be remarkably violent physical encounters with the guards, and often ending in pepper spraying. So there are other ways that other states have learned to manage youth behavior in ways that don't require 200 instances of pepper spray in a 10-month period and months-long solitary confinement stays and chaining people to tables when they're out of their cells. That's just beyond the pale.
Now, this is being approached as a class action lawsuit. So why did you take that course?
Well, it's a fairly standard approach in prison reform litigation. When the conditions of confinement are such that there's a policy or practice that basically applies to all of the prisoners in the same way, and what you want to do is change that policy or practice, you bring a lawsuit on behalf of all of the prisoners who are there. That's essentially what a class action does in this kind of a case. And it's often done in these kinds of cases. Most of the prison and jail litigation that I've been involved in has been class action litigation.
We're talking with Larry Dupuy right now, legal director for ACLU Wisconsin, talking about the lawsuit filed this week over the alleged excessive use of pepper spray and solitary confinement at juvenile correction facilities in the state. And we talked a bit about solitary confinement. What is the ACLU's stance on solitary confinement?
Well, basically, the ACLU's position, and this is a position that's shared by a number of other professional organizations, and including organizations that represent correctional officials, the Council of Juvenile Correctional Association administrators, for example, the National Commission on Correctional Health Care, all take the position that juveniles should not be subjected to solitary confinement at all for purposes of punishment. And to the extent that children may have to be occasionally separated from others to protect others or themselves, that should be for a 1 or maybe 2 hour, maybe 4 hour cooling off period. And if there still needs to be some separation, you're not talking at that point about behavior management. You're talking about probably a psychiatric problem that needs to be addressed entirely differently. We're basically taking the position in this case that many other organizations have already taken, that you simply should not be subjecting children to solitary confinement. And think about it. If you did this to your children, if you locked them in a room for even 5 days straight for 23 hours a day, that would be child abuse. You'd be investigated by the county. So our position is they really just can't be using it anywhere near the way that they're using it now.
Do you have an estimate about how many of these young people are being held in solitary confinement for amounts of time that the ACLU considers too long?
Almost all of them. I mean, basically, what happens is the kids get when they do something that is wrong, they get rolled, which is, you know, the term that the kids use, because they usually get put in a van and taken to one of the security cottages, which is the euphemism they use for the solitary confinement buildings. And they're there until they get a hearing. And the hearing is usually several days after they get there. So almost by definition, they're there longer than the 4 hours or 5 hours that we would say is acceptable. And there are, at any given time, between 22 and 33 kids locked up in the solitary cells. So there are 33, you know, between 20 and 33 kids at any one time who are probably there too long. We don't know exactly what percentage of the total population has been in solitary at some point, and we're not totally sure what, you know, the range of lengths of sentences are. But we certainly know that some of our clients have gotten sentences of more than 72 days in solitary confinement. And you see it very routinely for, 14 days, 15 days, 7 days.
As we wrap up, Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake are run by the state, and Governor Walker has declined to take a tour of these schools. What do you think of that decision?
I really think that it's an eye-opening experience to see the insides of these institutions, and not just the juvenile institutions. I mean, I think, you know, every judge should see where they might be sending their juvenile prisoners, but also their adult prisoners. I think it's a good thing to know what's happening on the inside as much as you can. Now, the reality is, normally when you go to one of these institutions for a tour, the tours tend to sort of give you the most antiseptic view that you could possibly have of the institution. So it's important, I think, to see it, to know what it looks like, to get a sense of, you know, some of the basics. You know, the size of these cells, for example, would be, I think, and the nature of, you know, what's in those cells would be troubling to see, even if they sort of cleared the kids and made it look better. But I think you need to also be aware that, you know, prisons are often, they're among the most opaque institutions in our democratic society. And, you know, it's unless you talk to people who have been there and or are there, it's hard to know how bad it can really be. And again, I don't want to say that this is really about misbehaving guards. It's just the nature of these institutions and systematic problems with funding them, training employees to deal with disputes and anger and disturbance in ways that are not violent in and of themselves.
Larry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Larry Dupuis is the legal director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Wisconsin, and he joined us to talk about the lawsuit filed this week over the alleged excessive use of pepper spray and solitary confinement at juvenile corrections facilities in Wisconsin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, fairy tales filled with magic, adventure, and unlikely scenarios don't really portray the world in a realistic way, but a psychologist says these stories may help children learn more compared to realistic stories. We'll learn more in a bit.
First, when Rachel Carson's landmark book, Silent Spring, first appeared in 1962, it was quickly branded the most controversial book of the time. It also became an instant bestseller.
Carrying a dire warning of the long-term danger of pesticides, Silent Spring became the most influential popular science book of the 60s. Here's Rachel Carson making her case.
We have to remember that children born today are exposed to these chemicals from birth, perhaps even before birth. Now, what is going to happen to them in adult life as a result of that exposure? We simply don't know. Because we've never before had this kind of experience.
The chemical industry vilified Carson, but her book sparked a national debate. It also prompted President Kennedy to launch the first ever investigation into pesticides and their impact on humans and the environment.
Carson's book is credited with launching the environmental movement. A new American Experience film about Rachel Carson premieres tonight on PBS. It explores how Carson transformed our relationship with nature and continues to do so 55 years after Silent Spring was published.
William Souter is with us now. He's the author of On a Farther Shore, The Life and Legacy of Rachel Carson, author of Silent Spring. He was also an advisor on the documentary, which will air on Wisconsin Public Television tonight at 7 p.m., William, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Nice to be with you.
Well, let's go back to 1962. What was the mood in the country like just before Rachel Carson's Silent Spring came out?
Well, this would have been the height of the Cold War. So, and the principal feature of that time, of course, is this standoff between the United States and the Soviet Union and this fierce arms race that was going on between the two countries, which involved the sort of continuous testing of nuclear weapons. And that is not unrelated to the point that Carson was making about pesticides. The clip you played just now is really interesting. It's hard for us to understand in 2017 that at one time, not so long ago, the idea of a chemical contaminant being a potential hazard either to the environment or to human health, that was a novel idea. And yet Carson understood that it was an existential problem. And she was able to illustrate that for the uninformed public by drawing a very clear parallel between the contamination of the environment with pesticides like DDT and the contamination of the environment with the radioactive fallout from the nuclear tests that were going on the entire time. It, well, I think, surprised people that were not alive back in 1962 or have forgotten. But in June of 1962 alone, the month when Silent Spring was serialized in the New Yorker magazine before it became a book, in that 1 month alone, the United States by itself tested 10 nuclear devices above ground in the atmosphere, and you know, putting many, many tons of highly radioactive fallout into the upper atmosphere. Nowadays, the thought of that is horrifying to us, but it was routine then. So it was a different world. It was a world convinced that there was better living through chemistry, that technology would cure the world of all its ills. Those are nice ideas, and in many cases they're true. But Carson's argument was that we need to be cautious. We need to understand that there may be unexpected outcomes when we begin tinkering with nature.
So given that this was a pretty radical idea, that she seemed to be flying in the face of this idea that science was a cure for all ills and DDT was a godsend, which is how it was viewed in the beginning, did she have trouble getting her message out there? Did people want to publish what she had to say?
Well, she was lucky, and people sometimes ask me if there could be another Rachel Carson. The problem is you have to start with someone who is one of the most famous and beloved authors on the face of the earth, which is what Carson was. In the mid-1950s, she had written three books about the ocean that were huge bestsellers that made her a household name literally around the world. And so, she didn't have any problem at all getting people to listen to her. Now, Silent Spring is a very different book. That's a very dire book. It's a fierce polemic against the, you know, indiscriminate use of pesticides. Not a call for the end of their use entirely, but certainly an urge, a call for people to be a lot more cautious and to be aware of what they were doing. But Carson, again, was very famous. This was also a time before we had so discredited the media as we have today. This was a time when facts still mattered and when print still mattered, and a writer could make a persuasive case that people would listen to. She was not without opposition, as you indicated. The chemicals industry and its allies and government fought back fiercely against Rachel Carson, but they picked the wrong person.
There is a scene in the documentary that is actually kind of, it's hard to watch. It's of Naples where people are being deloused and they're being just completely sprayed from head to toe with DDT. And it seems like this was billed as a good thing, so you can see how what she was saying really turned the ship on the way things were going.
Yeah, this was, you know, during the wars, Second World War, this was when DDT came into wide use by the military. And it was used in Naples in 1943 to halt the typhus epidemic. We should say categorically that it did work. It worked in many, many cases, helped eradicate malaria in some parts of the world, not all, but in many parts of the world. There's no question that DDT was effective. The question was whether was it harmful to organisms that were not the target, that is, to the environment generally or to human health. And that was really Carson's concern. She understood that we needed to control insect-borne diseases like typhus and malaria, but she wanted us to also understand that we might do collateral damage if we were too reckless in how we use those pesticides. As you say, DDT was thought to be a miraculous, near miraculous discovery. Paul Muller, the Swiss chemist who discovered DDT, won the Nobel Prize for it.
Can you talk a little bit about what Rachel Carson was like as a person and the way, sort of the personal roots of who she was and,
sure,
and how she related to the environment informed that book that she wrote that changed so many people?
Carson grew up in a small town just a little bit north of Pittsburgh. She was born in 1907. And her mother instilled a real appreciation for nature in her at a very early age. And also at a very early age, Carson decided that she really wanted to be a writer. And she started selling stories to children's magazines when she was 10 years old. When she got to college, she went as an English major, but about halfway through became captivated by biology and switched majors and eventually found a way to combine these two passions in life. That's really what you want to think of Rachel Carson as, a writer who wrote about science. And in some cases, it was about the ocean. In the case of Silent Spring, it was about pesticides. But she was a shy person. She spent most of her adult life living with her mother and a couple of cats, very quiet, but not afraid to speak out. And in the case of Silent Spring, not only was she not afraid to speak up, but she always said that she felt obligated to speak out. She had known since the early 1940s that there were potential problems with these pesticides, and by the late 1950s, she just felt she couldn't stay quiet anymore. And so silent spraying was, I think, in her own mind, a duty, an obligation that she needed to fulfill.
Can you give us a sense of the cultural and the political reaction that came after Silent Spring?
Well, this was something that really interested me because I've written a lot about American history and environmental history. It's always been a puzzle to me why we have this partisan argument over the environment. Why does a Republican feel differently about the environment than a Democrat does, even though both live in the same global ecosystem? And part of the reason for that divide doesn't explain everything, but a big part of it was the reaction to Silent Spring. When Carson's critics, and again, they came mainly from the chemicals industry and from their partners in government, really tried to discredit her by questioning her science, by questioning her motivations, and specifically by pushing her to the left side of the political spectrum. She was actually accused of being a communist or being in league with the Soviet Union in some way, and was accused of having an agenda that was to, you know, either curtail or eliminate the use of pesticides in the United States as a way of kind of bringing our agricultural output down to that of the Soviet Union. And so on the one side of this, you have on the left side of the political spectrum, scientists, people interested in the truth, people interested in the environment, people who want to conserve nature in its unadulterated state for future generations. And on the other side, you have business and its connections in government on the right side of the political spectrum. So if you look at the fight that we have now going on over climate change, it's exactly the same fight that we had over pesticides, and people have chosen up sides in exactly the same way they did over Silent Spring. So in an important way, Silent Spring not only launched the environmental movement, it kind of set the terms of the debate over the environmental movement.
William, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica.
That is William Sauter, author of On a Farther Shore, The Life and Legacy of Rachel Carson, author of Silent Spring. He was also an advisor on the New American Experience film called Rachel Carson, which will air on Wisconsin Public Television tonight at 7. For more information and listings, go to the schedule page at WPT.org.
Coming up, stories that feature fantastical scenarios may help kids learn better than realistic stories. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll hear from a state lawmaker about proposed changes to state forfeiture laws affecting how and when police can seize property from citizens.
First, if you think back to when you were a kid, you were probably told stories filled with magic, dragons, and adventure, or maybe going on that trek through the woods to get to grandmother's house and all the challenges, talking wolves, the frights along the way.
Looking back, those stories might seem like fun distractions and entertainment, maybe an escape from the real world. But our next guest says they might be more than that because children may actually learn more from fantastical tales than from realism.
Dina Weisberg joins us now. She's a senior fellow in the psychology department at the University of Pennsylvania, where she studies how imagination can affect learning. Dina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, what led you to tackle this issue of whether kids might learn as much, maybe even more, from a fantasy story as from a real life type story?
That result actually came as something of a surprise. The research that led to it was looking for a way to teach vocabulary words to kids in Head Start programs and other low-income preschools, trying to close the vocabulary gap that happens before kids reach kindergarten. And we wanted to use books as a way to engage the children in this new endeavor of word learning. And as part of the project, I thought it would be interesting to include an investigation of what kinds of books would do a better job of teaching these new words. So we had a set of books that were realistic and a set of books that were fantastical. and we read them to the kids. And overall, we were just looking to see whether this book reading technique would help them to learn the words at all. And then I additionally examined whether there would be a difference between these realistic books and the fantastical books. And it turned out, much to everyone's surprise, that the fantastical books were actually doing better, that our kids were learning the vocabulary words more deeply. They were able to report back more of the definitions of these new words that we were teaching from the fantastical stories. So that was the start of it. And then since then, I've tried to look more deeply into that that result, which was unexpected. And in a series of studies since then, which are still ongoing in my lab, we've found similar findings. We found, again, that under these circumstances, fantastical stories can teach better than the realistic ones. So I was surprised at first, but we've kept going down that road, and it's something that seems to keep happening.
So when we say fantastical stories, what are we talking about here? Kind of Harry Potter type things?
Yeah, it's in that vein. The ones that we used in the original study were books that had dragons and knights fighting dragons and were set in that kind of medieval fantasy world. In the work that I've done since then, we've narrowed down to using events in stories that violate ordinary causality, that violate what can usually happen in the course of events. So, for example, we have a hamster who can walk through the wall of its cage, or we have a flower that can talk, for instance. So those are the kinds of events that we're talking about. And we're trying to make these books, which we're writing in the lab, look similar to the stories that kids would be getting in their everyday lives. So they're not entirely completely off the wall. It's not that everything that's happening is completely unrealistic. They're more like in sort of a superhero genre, or Harry Potter is a good example there, where there's a lot of realism, but every once in a while something happens that just would not or could not happen in reality. And it seems to be those events that are important for kids learning.
And you write that a lot of the thinking on this topic would have led toward the idea that, no, the closer a reading is to a kid's actual experience, the more relevant it will seem to them. And so the better it's going to stick in their heads. It's going to seem, I'll understand that this word is useful if it's in a context that I might encounter in the real world. Your findings seem to run counter to that, though.
Exactly. And that's why it was really so unexpected the first time that this came up. Everything that we know from all the past research on learning and memory in children, in adolescents, in adults suggests that realism would be best for learning. You want to be able to take what you have in the book, and then you need to be able to apply that to a real world situation. And similarity is key for being able to do that. You have to notice that the thing that's happening in the book, or the word that's being used in the book, or the principle that the book is trying to teach can then apply to reality. And it seems like a no-brainer, and nearly all of the past research confirms that if the book is more similar to reality, you'll be able to notice that what the book is telling you can then be applied straightforwardly to reality. And what we're finding right now is really turning that on its head. And to be perfectly honest, I'm not yet 100% sure why.
Well, what is your working theory about why? What are you thinking that you're trying to test to figure out the answer to that question?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're trying to do in the lab right now, is to figure out what's going on. One of the most reasonable theories that I have going at the moment is that it's about attention, that these books that have some of these events that are a little bit different from what you might find in your everyday life are much more interesting to children. They're more engaging. They're grabbing children's attention. And if you're paying more attention, you're going to be able to learn better. So in some sense, that's an easy way to explain away these results. And that's one thing that we're looking for. Another suggestion that I think is more interesting and is a little bit more controversial is that it's not merely attention, that it's a particular kind of attention. That when you're reading a fantastical story and you encounter one of these events that's contrary to the rules of reality, something about that event says, hey, wake up. what's going on here is not what you expect. You need to be bringing some serious processing resources to figuring out what's happening in this book. So it's not just about paying more attention. It's about paying more careful attention precisely to the question of, can this happen? Can that not happen? How is this like what I encounter in my everyday life? How is it different? And it's that specific kind of attention to the events that's leading to the better learning.
We're talking to psychology researcher Dina Weisberg from the University of Pennsylvania, looking at research on fantasy reading, how it might affect kids' learning. Her research, anyway, finds that they learn new vocabulary words better from that fantasy story, maybe than from a realistic reading. And Dina, on a wider note, you study the role of imagination and engaging the imagination in learning. Why is that important?
Yeah. It's important for a lot of different reasons, and I really love being able to study this because it's surprising to a lot of people to hear me say that imagination is a crucially important tool for some of the more serious cognitive abilities that we have, like learning and reasoning and memory. What the imagination allows us to do is to get out of our current reality, and we can do that when we get out of our current reality and go to the world of Harry Potter, or we go to Middle Earth or something more fantastical. But we also use that in science, for instance. We use that when we're trying to think about, well, what could happen here? What might be a possible explanation for that pattern of results? What would happen if I were to pursue this line of inquiry? The imagination is everywhere if we look for it. It lets us plan for the future to think about what might happen if I engage in these particular actions. It lets us think about the past in different ways. Well, what would have happened if the Allies had lost the Second World War, for instance? And being able to ask those questions, being able to use our imagination to think about reality, can then help us understand the structure of reality more deeply. So being able to think about what might have happened if the Allies lost World War II can lead us to understand a little bit better why they won and why that didn't happen.
Do you think there might be something in there about what's going on in the brain with storytelling, the way we just want to know what happens next? And fantasy stories seem to do that, at least especially well. They engage sometimes in ways that more realistic things might not. I want to read the book about the hamster that walks through the wall. It sounds interesting.
Well, that particular book, I have to admit, is not super interesting because we created it in the lab to work with the children that we recruit for our studies. And so everything is very carefully controlled. But your point is definitely well taken, that there's something that seems really engaging about these studies, and we just want to know what happens next. We always ask kids questions to find out how much they remember about the different stories, to see if they're paying more attention. Do they remember more when there's more fantasy events going on, which would tell us something about whether or not they, like us, really want to find out what had happened in that story and are really engaging with those a little bit more.
Dina Weisberg is with us right now. She's a senior fellow in the psychology department at the University of Pennsylvania, where she studies the role that imagination plays in learning. And we're talking to her now about why children may learn more from fantasy stories than they do from realistic writing.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. As a child or as your parent, are fantasy stories, fantasy books, part of your in-house curriculum? Did you learn everything you needed to know from Harry Potter or The Lord of the Rings or The Chronicles of Narnia, you name it? Do you think we can get a lot of things out of fantasy or fantastic literature, stories, fairy tales, you name it, as much as maybe for more realistic writing? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation about the importance that fairy tales and fantasy can play in how children learn. Dina Weisberg is with us. She's a senior fellow in the psychology department at the University of Pennsylvania.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent or a teacher, do you read fantastical stories to your children, to your students? What have you seen in your old children or in your own upbringing? What did you read read what was read to you as a kid, do you feel like, yeah, you learned something about thinking or maybe even just vocabulary from fantasy type stories? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first call now. We've got Scott with us in Iowa. Scott, hi.
How are you doing?
Good.
I don't got a lot of time. I'm on the road, but I listened to you talk, and I think that's common sense, what you're saying. I don't know why someone would think different.
What is it about it that you think is common sense? You think that these stories are just better, and so we're going to learn more?
Well, what holds your interest is what I was thinking. I mean, if you had a chance to read a fictional book or the daily newspaper, which is usually old news by the time you get it either way, what are you going to remember? I mean, the book's going to bring you back. The paper's done the minute you put it down, basically.
All right, Scott, good point. Thanks for bringing that up, and I appreciate that call. And, Dina, what about that? Whatever holds your interest is what you're going to absorb. And books, especially these fantasy stories, they do have this compelling narrative thread. And if we want to find out what happens next, we have to figure out what some of these words mean.
Yeah, I really appreciate Scott's point there, because definitely the things that hold your interest are the things that are going to be learned from more easily. The interesting thing comes in when you look at the contrast between a fantasy story, so like a fictional fantasy story, and as opposed to a fictional reality story. So these are both things that have narratives and that could hold your interest more than, say, a newspaper column, which is definitely going to be much drier compared to the novel and then the fantasy story. And there's something of a fight, because the realistic novel is going to be more similar to reality, so you might think you learned from it better. And the fantasy book might be more interesting, and so you might think you learned from that one better. And just looking at it that way, it's difficult to make a prediction about which way it's going to go. It might depend on what kind of person you are. Some people really hate fantasy and science fiction. I don't happen to be one of them. As a deep, lifelong nerd, I feel very vindicated by this kind of research. But some people really dislike those kinds of books, and fantasy might not work as well for them. We really need to pay attention to who is doing the reading as well as what they're reading.
Scott, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Amy in Dubuque. Amy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think this is a really exciting topic, and I love the idea of that research. It fits so clearly with the stuff that I've been doing for the past 15 years. I work with children in the summertime in a summer camp that is specifically fantasy literature-based summer camp. It started out as a Harry Potter camp, and and then it went in a lot of different ways, but it's always based on fantasy literature and fairy tales and King Arthur and that kind of thing. The thing that I think is so exciting is that not only, and I used to do a lot of literacy research as well, but not just the little bitty kids. And I think it's interesting how kids all the way up the scale are deeply involved in their learning. It's not a gifted and talented camp, but even in the sciences, to use the imagination as a springboard for studying science. You know, we had, for example, a whole unit at camp where the kids were studying DNA and how to do DNA, and they took their own DNA, and then part of the drama was that there was a werewolf among us, and so they had to research, you know, what would the DNA of a werewolf look like, and they still talk about it, and they know how to do it, they know the science behind it, and we've had, you know, math questions that are philosophically related to fairy tales and all that. I just think the imagination is so important in learning how to learn and how to think, as well as the emotional component. I think there's something there as well, and I'm wondering if in your research, the emotional component of imagination has come into play at all.
Amy, thank you so much for sharing that experience. Dina, what do you think?
Thanks, Amy. That sounds like a fantastic summer program. I've got a 4-year-old son. I think he would love to join you at that camp and find werewolves with you. So thank you so much for doing that. I think a lot of educators are often afraid to use fantasy, particularly for kids at the younger ages. They get very worried that children won't be able to tell the difference between real and what's fantasy, and that they'll end up believing that there are really werewolves or having other sorts of detrimental effects on their education. So I wish more people would do what you're doing and take advantage of the fact that kids find these processes so interesting, and that educators can leverage that to get across some of these more serious scientific topics. I think that's great. With respect to the question you asked about emotions, I think that's also a really important piece of the puzzle. It's not something that I've looked at directly so far. We've been trying to teach more mundane facts, biological principles, definitions of new words, things like that. They're a lot easier to control and to test in the lab. But there certainly is a place in fantasy for being able to exercise your emotions and being able to try on these different roles that can help you stretch and grow as a person. Certainly, there's a way to do that with realistic fiction as well. But I think fantasy gives you permission to go a little bit farther than you would otherwise. And it may be that it has these good effects on emotional development as well. We'll have to wait and see what the future research brings there.
Amy, thank you so much for sharing that. And we're going to go next to Pedro in Milwaukee. Pedro, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to share?
I was calling because I am a person with dyslexia, and when I was a child, I had a very difficult time learning how to read. My mom noticed that I had an interest in comic books, so she started to actually help me collect comic books, which in turn actually helped me learn how to read. I was wondering, this question actually just came to me. I was wondering, has there been studies about fantasy or comic books or something of that nature helping people with learning disabilities?
Pedro, thanks for that. And Dina, do you know anything about that? Comic books and the role of learning and maybe with dyslexia?
Yeah, you're making a great point there. I don't know of any research off the top of my head specifically about comic books and dyslexia, but I think it ties into the rest of the conversation that we've been having, that if you can find that thing that you're passionate about and you're really going to work to understand it, and if that thing happens to be comic books that have this fantastical element, then I think it's all to the better. I think that you really have to work with the kids and meet them where they are as far as their interests are concerned, and that will draw them into the learning process.
Pedro, thanks a lot for sharing your experience talking to Dina Weisberg from the University of Pennsylvania about fantasy and learning. And we'll go next to Tom with us in Toma. Tom, hi.
How are you doing?
Great. What did you want to bring up, Tom?
Thanks for taking my call, and kudos to the lifelong nerds. I grew up when, you know, Star Wars became on the big screen, and I was about 10 years old, and those movies were just something that inspired me to pursue the science. And through my college career, you know, I still find myself in the toy aisle at the age of 40 because those movies really pushed me toward the science background and the science degree and being more innovative in the classroom, you know.
Tom, thank you so much for sharing that. And Dina, we hear that Star Wars and Star Trek, for that matter, motivating people to pursue studies and even careers in science.
Yeah, I hear that from a lot of people when I discuss that work. And I think it's great that we can finally start taking that seriously, that these kinds of fantastical situations can have these amazing real life effects. A lot of folks have told me that Star Wars or Star Trek or Narnia or Lord of the Rings were such an important motivating force in what they're now doing with their lives. And so if science fiction can spark science fact, I think that's fantastic. Remember that a lot of the inventions that we have around us today were initially fantasy. So I have a little device in my purse that I can use to communicate with people across the globe, or that I can use to send them pictures, or that I can use to look up just about any fact that's ever been discovered. And that was fantasy at a certain point. And somebody thought, well, what would happen if we tried to make that real? So I think we owe a lot of our modern technology and devices, and to a certain extent, a lot of the scientific advances that have been made were something that at one point someone had to just dream up.
Dina, briefly, as we wrap up, can we adults benefit from imaginative thinking in our day-to-day learning lives?
Sure. I think adults are fundamentally not that much different from children in many, many ways. And I think this is one of them, that if it's something that sparks your interest, if it's something that can hold your attention, and if fantasy is the thing that does that and helps you learn, then absolutely.
Dina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
That's Dina Weisberg, senior fellow in the psychology department at the University of Pennsylvania, where she studies the role that imagination can play in learning. She joined us today to talk about how stories of fantasy may be able to help children learn maybe more than stories based in reality. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your experiences, learning, or teaching, for that matter, students or kids. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. You can find out more about Dina's research while you're there, and let us know, was there a fantasy story, a fairy tale, a book, maybe Harry Potter, that really got you or your kid learning?
We're a little late to the party on this one, but yesterday was National Handwriting Day, and with the goal of celebrating, quote, the purity and power of handwriting, and to try to get us to brush up on our cursive, I guess.
It could be a tall order, yeah, to sell handwriting in an age of email and texting, but supporters of cursive say it's a beautiful way to get us to slow down and carefully express ourselves.
And this was on John Hancock's birthday yesterday, who had a beautiful signature, so
and
there's
a big
inspiration.
Signature. Mm-hmm. I kind of peaked in ninth grade, and my handwriting even then was terrible, terrible. Even elementary school writing, that was my one worst grade every year. And now, I mean, how often do you write cursive?
I do still use, I use a hybrid, actually, of cursive and just simple blocky letters as well. And you're writing something fizzly over there.
I'm putting it to the test right now.
Yeah, you do not have the best writing. I will say that.
I'm going to test and see if you can read it. Wow, I really have to think. This may not happen in time.
We are waiting anxiously for this lovely...
I'm having to remember how to do individual letters.
And handwriting is so exciting on the radio.
Okay, here. Can you read this?
We should go to the Strand and get cooked.
Close. We should go to the store and get cookies. Basic idea communicated successfully in cursive on Handwriting Day, the day after Handwriting Day. This is Central Time.